Hello and welcome to the Offside Rule Women's World Cup edition in association with Spotify. Yep, that's right, I'm not Kate Borsay. She's enjoying a well-earned night off, so it's me, Matt Davis-Adams, at the helm for one night only, talking you through all the action as the 2019 Women's World Cup finally reached the knockout stages. Now, we know this podcast and the hosting thereof is usually a woman's domain, but God bless those equal opportunity-loving employers here at Muddy Knees Media. They know just how hard it is for people like me, a white British male aged 25 to 49, to get a break in this industry, so they very kindly granted me an opportunity. With me to discuss the first batch of last 16 games in France are a pair of stalwarts of this campaign for Team Offside Rule. First up, author, journalist and downright doctor from parts unknown, hello Carrie Dunn.
Hello, I'm so tired.
And alongside Carrie is a journalist and broadcaster with more credits than the list of assisters for the USA against Thailand, than the BBC, TalkSport, The Voice and plenty more beside. Welcome back, Anne-Marie Batson.
Thank you very much for that introduction.
Hang on. I'm just getting word that those introductions are being checked by VAR in case of mistaken identity. So, Saturday saw the round of 16 get underway. The final game was a bit of a belter. Australia 1, Norway 1. After 120 minutes, Norway win 4-1 on penalties. Carrie, it went the distance this game. It's pretty late as we are recording this, but it wasn't like it was a really drab, we're playing for penalties. Certainly, in terms of the extra time period, loads happened.
Yeah, it was a busy old match. I mean, it started off with that Sam Kerr chance after like 25 seconds. It was so end-to-end, really hefty challenges going in, lots and lots of opportunities being made, some terrific goalkeeping again. Yeah, great game to watch.
Anne-Marie, before the match, Aussie midfielder Chloe Legazzo said about Norway, it's a Viking culture, so it's going to be a hard game. Aussies like a good scrap, and so do they. She wasn't wrong. It was really kind of bruising encounter.
Absolutely. She's absolutely spot on. I mean, this is a team, they've played each other several times. Australia has won their matches, and then Norway have won theirs, and then they've had a draw. So I was expecting it to be a close match. And as I've mentioned, they met each other before. They know, as a team, they know each other very well. So yeah, fascinating end to end.
So it goes to penalties, but how we got there? Norway go a goal up just after the half hour. Isabel Herlovsen collecting Karina Sivek's through ball after it was missed by an Aussie defender. Takes one touch and then shoots. Really good goal, Carrie. And also, we'd been talking about the profligacy of Herlovsen and Graham Hansen in previous shows. So kind of important for Norway that one of them at least had their shooting boots on tonight.
Yeah, it was an interesting thing for the Norway attack, because obviously Australia's fragility in defence has been talked about a lot. I mean, there were plenty of chances created, and you would have thought they would have actually converted more of them. I mean, the fact that Australia equalised so late on, I mean, Norway would have been kicking themselves that they didn't actually get that wrapped up in 90 minutes.
Yeah, they probably should have. Australia thought they were going to get an equaliser, Anne-Marie, when they got a penalty for handball by Maria Thorisdottir. Then the referee puts her finger to her ear, and then she goes and checks it, and then she checks it again, and then she checks it again, and then the VAR team at their base say, hey, maybe you want to have another look at that. And then she changes her mind. I think we're all in agreement that it wasn't a penalty and they got to the right decision, but man, it's a laborious process getting there.
Absolutely. And as I sit in this room, I still believe in VAR. I do. I really do. But there are things that need to be looked at. Like the way that you've just described that process, it's far, far, far too long. Either the referee makes the decision, or she goes to he or she, depending on what the game is, they go and look at the screen and make the decision. This whole thing of backwards and forwards, it just takes far, far, far too long. And I don't think, again, the crowd knew exactly what was going on for a period of time as well. So, but it ramped up a bit of tension to see which way it was going to go, because, you know, Australia at that time is, the early chance that Sam Kerr had would have put Australia on the front foot, and here they go, they've got an opportunity and it was snatched away from them.
Yeah, Norway win the game, but we're going to be talking about Sam Kerr quite a lot. Bless her, she had the ball tucked in the crook of her arm, ready to take this penalty, only for it to be overruled. Then she gets a goal disallowed for offside an hour in, probably the correct call. Australia pretty much on top for the second half of the second half, certainly, and they eventually get the equaliser 7 minutes from time, the end of the 90 minutes, that is. Elise Kellen-Knight, direct from a corner. Carrie, I really wanted to talk about how much I love Maren Mjelde and what a great defender she is. And then her team concede a goal straight from a corner. And then the narrative to this game before was kind of, well, Australia have got a bit of a ropey defence and Norway are really difficult to break down. Turns out if you just shoot from corners, you can score against them.
Yeah, it was an odd one, wasn't it? I mean, we watched it over and over again to try and work out whether it had taken deflection, trying to watch the bounce slow it down. And yeah, it was just peculiar bounces right in front of people's legs. And so the keeper couldn't see what was happening and the defenders behind them couldn't see it. So yeah, a very, very odd corner to score directly from. It wasn't kind of like an epic looping thing into the back stick and to the top corner. No, it was just bobbling around and just kind of skidded in.
So that meant that we go to extra time for the first time in the tournament. Bear in mind, it was only the second game that had the potential to go to extra time. And there, Anne-Marie, Alana Kennedy gets sent off for Australia. This is right at the end of the first period of extra time, bringing down Lisa Marie Utland when she was through on goal. First straight red card of this tournament, and on this occasion, a pretty easy decision for the referee.
And Kennedy's face as well. She had this look of, why me? Kind of like, because of what you've done. Exactly, yeah. And you know, at least she did walk off the pitch quite quickly. I must give her credit for that. But yeah, absolutely, it was a straight red card, no argument at all.
So Norway unable to break down Australia in extra time. We go to penalties, and my goodness me, one team were really good with their penalties and one team not so much. Norway faultless, but Carrie, Sam Kerr watch.
She's put it wide. First blood goes Norway's way. Not even close from Sam Kerr. The pressure, the occasion.
Arguably the worst penalty that the game of football has ever seen. Certainly in the top 10, I would have thought.
It's definitely up there. And of all the players that you think are going to convert a penalty coolly, calmly, give a side, you know, the chance to actually compete in this penalty shootout, you'd think it would be Kerr. But no, it was Waddlesque in its epic awfulness. It was just bad. A terrible penalty.
Do you think that Australia will have practiced them, Anne-Marie? Because it didn't really look like it.
I agree. I don't think they do practice their penalties. I don't know what was going on, but Kerry's absolutely right. It was like the ball just went flying up in the air. There was nothing. You're looking at it, I'm thinking, is it going to come back down at some point? Because it went that high above the crossbar. And yes, I don't think, to watch Norway, when they were taking their penalties, how clinical they were, and they knew exactly where they wanted the ball to go. Whereas with Australia, it was just like, hit it and let's hope for the best. And it cost them.
Helmstedt made a save as well for Norway. As I say, they dispatched all their penalties pretty easily. A lot of coolness under pressure from them, actually, in the situation, because they would have been forgiven for being frustrated at not being able to break down the 10 players for, I mean, it was probably about 20 minutes that they played against in the end, but they managed to put that behind them and say, OK, let's go and win the shootout. And that's to be admired.
Yeah, and Norway have, you know, they have a record of this, and the goalkeeper also has a record of doing brilliantly in shootouts. So, if you know, it's not really that much of a surprise that they did so well. But I think the scale on which they did so well and the scale at which Australia was so bad are just much, much grander than I think we'd have expected.
So it's Norway through to the quarterfinals for the first time since 2007. A big turnaround for them in the last couple of years. Anne-Marie, they'll play England or Cameroon. Obviously, that game takes place tomorrow. Will the winner of that match have an advantage? Because this one's been so long and so brutal. Even if England-Cameroon goes to extra time, it's not going to have the kind of mental fatigue of this game, or is unlikely to, you would assume. Is it just, it's not till Thursday, we'll be over it by then?
I think because the game is not till Thursday, I think there'll be plenty of time for recovery mentally and physically as well. But, you know, if England do get through their match against Cameroon, I think England need to be worried. What fascinated me, or what struck me about the Norway team, is the fact that, you know, they defended so resolutely, and the next minute they go on the attack that quickly. It was literally like a second. If England just switch off for that second and Norway go on the counter, then they're going to be in trouble. So I don't think, if England do get through, I don't think it's going to be as easy as people think it will be.
Well, we shall find out. Norway go on to face the winner of England versus Cameroon. More on that game later. Before, though, we're going to look back at Germany against Nigeria, which also took place earlier today. So Germany booked their place in the quarterfinals. They'll face either Sweden or Canada. That after a relatively straightforward win against Nigeria in Grenoble. Hope that was good enough for you, Kate. It wasn't really, was it? The outcome was all but decided after half an hour of this game. Goals from Alexandra Popp marking her 100th appearance for Germany in style, and Sara de Brit's penalty shortly after. Leah Schuller added a third late on, but once again, VAR was in the spotlight. I'm keen not to dwell too much on, you know, was it, wasn't it, aspects of the various decisions. It was used four times in the first half alone here, Carrie. Should we be questioning the quality of the on-pitch referee rather than the fact that it keeps going to VAR, or is it just natural that they are going to think, well, I've got this thing to fall back on and it's going to come into play anyway, and football's just essentially been ruined?
Okay, so here's the thing that I object to with VAR. So they've brought in this entire new system on the grandest stage of them all for women's football. They're basically using the Women's World Cup as a trial period, as they did with the 3G pitches in Canada 4 years ago. That's one thing that really gets on my nerves. The second thing is that the way that VAR is being used this time round is so different to the way it's been used in men's tournaments previously. So I heard Casey Stoney at halftime and after the match this afternoon on television saying that the referees aren't up to the job and they're not kind of sure in their decision making. How can you possibly be sure in your decision making where your every decision is being undercut by suggesting that you go and review it? You can't have any confidence in what you're doing or the job you're doing. And if you do make a mistake, it's being shown again and again and again. So it's being shown up. It's almost like everyone is being pointed towards anything that you've ever done wrong during a match. So the way that VAR is being used is just hideous. And the way it was used in this match, yes, by the letter of the rules now, that's exactly how it should have been used. But my God, it felt like that there was maybe, what, 5 minutes of actual open play during that first half. There was so much going backwards and forwards to looking on the sidelines. And yes, okay, I understand the idea is so that decisions are correct, but it's completely ruining it as a spectacle. I don't want to watch someone running back and forwards to the touchline to watch a big TV screen. That isn't what football's about. This is supposed to be the pinnacle of people's career, and it's being ruined for the players, yes, for fans, yes, but also for the referees. They can't want to be working like this, and I feel bad for them that they are getting so much negative attention in this way when it is entirely not their fault.
Anne-Marie, you're a VAR fan. Do you think in 4 years' time, or maybe it'll take a little longer than that, we'll look back on this and go, I remember when it was really rubbish and no one knew how to use it, and now it's been the saviour of the game? Do you think eventually it's going to come good and we'll all be a big fan?
I don't know if everybody's going to be a big fan. I think it's you either like it or you don't like it when it comes to VAR or VAR. For me, as I've mentioned, I am a fan of VAR. What frustrates me, though, it's just so obvious where things are going wrong with it, and why are those things not being corrected? Like Carrie just pointed out, the length of time that it takes to review a decision, the fact the ref has to go to the side of the pitch to review a decision, the fact that the crowd doesn't know what's going on. You know, we all sit here and we're thinking we can see these things. They are so obvious. So why are not FIFA sorting it out? And I do object to the fact, you know, they've used this at the Women's World Cup, the pinnacle of the women's game, to test this, and it shouldn't be done like that at all. And I think now is the time to actually, why doesn't FIFA hold their hands and go, you know, we got this wrong, we shouldn't have used it at this tournament, and the things that we need to go and clear up, let's go back to the drawing board and get this right, because I think it's just going to get more frustrated for the fans and for the players and the managers as well.
All right, we'll try not to talk about VAR too much more in this podcast. Let's talk about some things that actually happened in the match. For more on it, producer Abby spoke with Ellen Hanisch from FussballTaysen.com.
We expected it to be not an easy game, but one of the easier games in the round of the last 16. But nevertheless, Nigeria was a tough opponent. It was extremely hard to play in the heat of this day, because the players didn't really expect it to be that hot.
Yeah, it looked very, very hot in the Stade des Alpes, and it's good practice for if Germany get to the semi-finals and final, because Lyon looks like it's going to be an absolute scorcher the first week of July. Looking at this match, though, the way I see it, we can take a pro and a con from the German performance. The pro being that Germany is still yet to concede a goal in this tournament, which is impressive given that that back four is really quite new playing together. But at the same time, at the opposite end of the pitch, Germany really could have scored a heck of a lot more goals, and that didn't happen. Is there concern there?
Yeah, I think we are a bit lucky that we didn't concede a goal because, or that we haven't conceded a goal yet, because the defense wasn't that good in the first matches, but they improved. Some people say it's a German thing that the German teams on World Cups improve from game to game. Mm. Sometimes the final pass today, the final pass was missing, and the crosses should have been better, in my opinion. It's sometimes a bit too slow, too obvious what they want to do. So
I suppose the heat had something to do with the pace of the match a bit today.
Yeah. Could be, yeah.
Yeah. Obviously, the German team is generally built around Jennifer Marazan. She has a broken toe. Post-match, though, she has been saying, "It will remain painful for weeks, but I'm not scared. I probably cannot play an entire match, but I was happy I was not needed today." So again, another positive thing for Germany that Marazan wasn't needed in this match. But going to the quarterfinals, they'll face either Sweden or Canada. Do we think that she'll be needed in the starting 11 or perhaps as a substitute in that match?
I think as a substitute, it could be fine. Maybe not in the quarterfinal, but if they reach the semifinal, because after the match, Martina Voss-Tecklenburg, the manager, said that the team is playing for her, and they are motivated to stay as long in the tournament as possible for her. Mm. Would be good for them to reach the semifinals, and then perhaps she could be substituted, because I think a broken toe is really, really painful and would be a bit dangerous to bring her too early.
Ellen Hanisch there. As for Nigeria, they scraped through as the fourth ranked of the four best third place teams. It looked like this was too big of a step up in opposition for them, really. Carrie, Asisat Oshoala, we've spoken a lot about her. She wasn't fit enough to start the game. Am I being harsh in saying it wouldn't have made any difference if she had?
I don't think it would have made any difference at all. We talked earlier on off air about the Germany team, and I really have an admiration for the way that they get things done. It was, I hesitate to say efficient, but it really was. They did what they had to do. They didn't let any of the VAR nonsense get into their heads. They managed to defend very stoutly against what Nigeria did have to offer against them. And yeah, they were by far the better team. And I don't think if Oshoala had been there, it would have made any difference at all.
Germany doing Germany stuff, just kind of quietly going about their business, scoring goals, not letting any in. It feels a bit ominous.
It does feel a bit ominous. And it's Germany doing what they do. They're just getting it over the line. But for me, they're not thrilling me as a team. And I expected more from Germany, I guess. I expected them to be a team to be feared. And I'm not sure if I'm feeling that from them yet. But as Carrie says, they are a team that getting the job done. It is about getting the job done at the end of the day. So I don't know. I just expected more from Germany. We haven't seen it.
Remember, they're without Jennifer Marazan today as well. So obviously she is their danger player, the one that drew a lot of the attention in the run-up to the tournament. So, maybe it's not necessarily exciting. It's not glamorous, but it doesn't really matter if you're stringing wins together, because that's what you need to do in tournament football.
Yeah, and for this game, Nigeria needed to park the bus. Didn't happen today. But, congratulations to them, for reaching the World Cup. And I'm sure they'll go back with loads of memories.
Yeah, another big plus for Germany, really, is that they haven't had to use Marazan in this match. She's saying she's going to be in pain for the rest of the tournament, but she thinks she can get through it. Lastly on it, Carrie, more broadly, disappointing tournament thus far for African teams. As we record, only Cameroon left in it. Is there something that we can say generally about the African teams here that they maybe haven't got, that they can look to improve to have a better showing? Or is it just down to the individual teams have individual failings?
Something they haven't got quite often is funding. And, it's the same with a lot of the nations that are coming up now. What's happened is that FIFA have expanded the number of teams in the tournament, and they've kind of dangled it as a carrot to encourage federations to invest in it. So, yes, we're seeing kind of more smaller teams or less established football, women's football nations come through. So, the experience of a World Cup is going to be great for these federations. Hopefully attract more investment back at home. And, I think Cameroon might do better against England than some people are predicting tomorrow, actually. So, yeah, ask me again tomorrow night.
All right, that's a nice tease into our look ahead to tomorrow's games. But that's Saturday's action done. Two more games to come on Sunday. We'll look ahead to England versus Cameroon and France's clash with Brazil next. It's Matt Davis Adams in the big presenter chair, ably aided by the minds of Carrie Dunn and Anne-Marie Batson. England v Cameroon then on Sunday, the first of two tasty ties to look forward to. Action kicking off in Valenciennes at 4:30pm UK time. It's the ultimate big cat grudge match between the indomitable lionesses of Cameroon and the plain old lionesses from jolly old England. Quite the contrast in group stage performances from these two. England flawless with 3 wins from 3. Cameroon scraping through in dramatic style after that last gasp win against New Zealand. Carrie, on paper, England are heavy favourites here. They're 43 places higher than Cameroon in the rankings, but you think that they might struggle in this game?
I didn't say that necessarily. I just think they're going to be more of a challenge than some people are predicting. Yes, okay, in terms of the group stages, the first two matches, Cameroon were kind of not in it. That third game against New Zealand just kind of shows, I think, at best, what Cameroon's qualities are. The fact that they kind of, they do keep fighting. They are indomitable. I like that word. I'm going to use it more in regular conversation. Mm-hmm. They are indomitable. They're going to keep fighting right to the end. And I know that Phil Neville talks about England's fighting spirit and he wants kind of 20% more during the knockout stages. Cameroon are going to step up too. They've got nothing to lose against this lot. You've got FIFA nominated players of the year in that team. You've got players playing in France, in Spain, in Swales, the WSL. And the Cameroon players are going to be thinking, you know, if we throw everything at this lot, doesn't matter if we get beaten 5-0, because that's what everyone's expecting.
And we are indomitable.
Exactly, indomitable.
In terms of England and Marie, Phil Neville mixed and matched his team to an almost unbelievable extent so far. He said he had a team in mind for every game in the group stage. Surely now we're at this point of the tournament, he needs to have an 11 in mind for the last 16, the quarters, the semi and the final. Is it going to turn out to have been a hindrance that he's not got a settled 11 that have played together to this stage? Or do you think it's going to be a similar team to the one that beat Japan?
I think he has a set of core players that he uses for each of his games. So I think we can confidently say, you know, Steph Horton will be there. Lucy Bronze probably. Millie Bright, I'm not too sure about. Jill Scott, definitely. In the Nikita Paris. And I think maybe, I don't know, Nikita I'm slightly wavering on. But I think those other players that I've mentioned, I think he's pretty much set on. And then he just works around everybody else. I'm not even going to try and guess which way he's going to go with this, because every time I try and think I've got it straight in my head, he comes out with something completely different. So what do I know? But does it work in his favour? Yeah, I think the obvious thing is it keeps the players on their toes. But at the same time, you know, you've got to have that chemistry and dynamic and know who you work really well with. And, you know, for example, we know that Nikita works really well with Lucy Bronze. Will he use that combination tomorrow? I don't know. We know that Steph Horton and Millie Bright, you know, they did keep like 14 clean sheets. They work well together, but he might mix it up again. So I don't know. I don't know if he knows his best. I'd like to think he does know his best 11. He's just keeping his cards close to his chest.
Carrie, if you were going to pick Stanway or Kirby and then Daly or Paris for this game, which do you think would be better suited?
Who I would pick or who I think Phil Neville would pick? Because that isn't necessarily the same question.
Let's go with who you would pick.
I'd pick Stanway and Daly.
Okay, and who do you think Big Phil's going to pick?
I think he'll pick Stanway and Paris.
All right, and how about Karen Carney? She's been on sub all three games so far. We hear that she's the teacher's pet. What's she got to do to get a start?
I really don't know. I would have actually played it from the start against Japan. I have to share this. Like, when I was watching the Japan game, my sister was texting me and she said the thing she loves about watching Karen Carney on the bench is Karen Carney is very bad at concealing her thoughts. You can see what she thinks all the time. And it's absolutely true. Between you come up to the bench, you can see her, you know, her emotions are written all over her face. And you can see she was dying to get on. And Phil Neville was giving her a last minute pep talk. And she was thinking, shut up. I want to get on now. I want to get on. I want to play. I can do this. And yeah, I would love to see Karen Carney actually start, but I don't think she will. I think they're going to use her as an impact sub the entire way through.
If she did start, Anne-Marie, who would you have her coming in for?
I couldn't call it because
it's a tough job that he's got, because the squad is quite sort of evenly matched throughout the 23 players, isn't it? You know, all the central midfielders seem to be of a similar level. You know, you've got central defenders who seem to be pretty good. You've got Ellen White, but then you've got loads of great options to replace her if needs be. It kind of feels a bit mismanaged in that he's made so many changes, but at the same time, you can see why he's found it so difficult to find a settled team.
Yeah, and I think my plan is, if Phil Neville was to ask me about tomorrow, my plan would be...
Which he should.
Thank you.
You're very kind, both of you. Go for the wide areas. Who are the best players that go wide? That would be my piece of advice to Phil Neville, and just work it from that, and hopefully they get the win.
Some milestones to be aware of for England. Jill Scott will break Peter Shilton's record of 17 appearances for England at World Cups if she features, which she surely will. And Ellen White needs just one more goal to match Farrah Williams' all-time record of 5 in World Cup finals for the Lionesses. Now, it's high time we caught up with Lindsay Hooper to find out how she's getting on in Valenciennes. Lindsay, what's it like?
So it seems the main attraction here is a bowling place, which I am really happy about because, one, I haven't been bowling for a long time. I'm a little bit competitive, so the temptation to try and get a few strikes, I won't resist. Mm-hmm. And it also is showing all the football for later as well. But not only that, it has a pool table, table tennis, all those sorts of things. I love it. So it hasn't got much, but what it has got, I really like.
Have you got special shoes?
I'm sure I'm going to be given some. I don't know how they compare to the quality of bowling alleys back at home.
Well, look forward to
a French twist.
We'll look forward to updates on that as the tournament continues. if we talk about some actual football, then England against Cameroon is the game. Phil Neville's done his press conference, a pretty jovial affair by all accounts. What was he saying ahead of the big game?
It was. There were some really light moments. And I mean, part of what he was trying to stress is that it's so important for the England team to be having fun away from match play. It's something that he said from the beginning, but that actually filtered into the press conference today because he started having a bit of a laugh and a joke himself. The Cameroon press conference was a few hours earlier. So some journalists decided not to go to open training. They went to that instead to see what the Cameroon coach had to say. And by all accounts, he felt that there were a couple of weaknesses to be exploited in England, didn't mention what they were, and then those were put to Phil Neville, and he just joked and quipped away to say, well, he was very complimentary about me, and that's why I like him. So that was the first bit. And then I'm not sure whether you're aware, but they're known as the Indomitable Lionesses. So this is all over social media, and it was put to Phil as well, and Jill Scott, who was alongside him. You know, what name would you put in front of the Lionesses? Phil kindly stitched Jill up because he's like, I think I'm going to ask Jill this one. She went for Irreplaceable. And then the journalist went, and you, Phil? And then she said, is that not good enough for you? So I think we should get behind it. Maybe make a hashtag, Irreplaceable Lionesses,
all right,
just to give us some support.
Yeah, that sounds good. We'll see if our listeners can come up with anything better than that. In terms of Phil Neville, I'm interested. You've interviewed dozens of managers over the last few years. How do you think he's doing in terms of dealing with the media? Because there's a kind of perception of him before the tournament, you know, that he was a bit of a nerd, I suppose. Is he kind of turning that around?
He's openly actually said, only today, he's openly said in the press conference that he probably came into this job a little bit studious, a little bit serious, and that he's had to learn to not be like that because that isn't what is getting the best out of the girls. And it comes back to that, you know, fun element of it all. And so I think what I would describe him as personally is quite adaptable. You know, he's trying to make this team play in a different way. He's trying out new players. He's bedded in some youth. He's not afraid to ditch people. He has this philosophy of rotation that he's sticking by and a system that he wants to stick by. But in regards to his approach to it all, then he's been completely flexible. You know, he hasn't been a hard taskmaster. He's talked about managers that influenced him. He hasn't exactly gone for the whole Sir Alex Ferguson approach, but he has taken little snippets from different people who have influenced him in his own career, like David Moyes as well. And that came up as well today about halftime team talks. And they were saying, well, you know, how long do you get with the players? How long do you go in the dressing room for? Is that ever an issue? And he said, look, I let them have a bit of a cooling off period. And I only need 2 minutes. I just need 2 minutes with them to get my message across. across, and then I just leave again and let them get on with it. They're old enough and wise enough and drilled enough to know how to go and perform in the second half. And I think that's where all the eyes will be on this match, because it so far has been the second half performances where levels have dipped and perhaps it's been a little disappointing.
Lindsay, that's great. Go get a turkey, which as we all know means three strikes in a row, or I guess it'd be
d'onde
in French. You can impress that. What do you call the pin monkeys? Go tell the pin monkeys in the alley that you're going for a d'onde, and you know, you might get a free pair of bowling shoes to take home with you.
Lovely. I will go and try my luck.
As for Cameroon, how'd you get with Ongene, who seems to be the biggest threat in the team? They scout these players well enough. You'd think that even the biggest threat in Cameroon's team should be relatively well marshalled by an England defence that looks pretty good so far, having conceded just one goal.
You would think so, and I would imagine they're going to keep the same back four as last time, which I think probably is the best back four that they have. So, yeah, I mean, whichever 11 Phil Neville picks, I think it is a solid 11. I don't necessarily think it's always his best 11, even though it's a good 11, if that makes sense. I'm so tired, I'm so sorry.
It's good, it's nice to hear the number 11, and you said it quite a lot there. So that's the first match of the day. The second game of the day should be a belter. Host France welcoming the occasionally erratic, sometimes fantastic and always unpredictable Brazil to the Stade Océan in Le Havre. France wowed us on opening night by dismantling South Korea. Fair to say, despite finishing the group stage with a 100% record, they haven't quite hit the heights since then.
I'm so hyped for this game. I think it's going to be so much fun. France. I mean, all those adjectives you used for Brazil could quite easily also apply to France. This is going to be topsy-turvy. I think this will be end-to-end too.
Anne-Marie, much has been made of the seven Lyon players in Corinne Diacre's squad. Is there enough depth beyond that, though, for France to go all the way, do you think?
I think so. I do think so. I think, I'm looking forward to Renard going up again. That's going to be a fascinating watch. I mean, you know, Lyon are one of the best team, well, is the best team in the world in terms of women's football. I think they'll be absolutely fine.
Another sellout crowd, bit of pressure on them because of that, but they've had to cope with that all the way through so far. So you would think that it won't be something that will derail them in this game.
No, I mean, you know, if it is a sellout, whether it's a proper sellout or, you know, a FIFA sellout, no, I don't think there's any pressure on France. You know, having been hosts and having these kind of partisan home crowds, they seem to have just benefited from it the whole way through the group stages. So I expect that just to continue through the knockout stages too.
Right, for a Brazilian perspective on the game, producer Abby, who's been busy, has been speaking with ESPN correspondent and Totally Football Show regular Natalie Gedra.
Where can Brazil hurt France? Because the way I see it, Brazil probably going to have to win that first half due to the fact that their players are a lot older and therefore will tire in that second half, and France could possibly look to build on a strong final, I don't know, half hour of that match. Where can Brazil really take France to bits and score goals?
Yeah, and we have to take into consideration that France's attack is really quick.
Yes.
So and we have been having problems defensively. So this is a big point of concern for Brazil, because the defense has been a bit fragile at times and making a few mistakes, especially with set pieces. And that's exactly the strongest point from France. So when we consider that Brazil can hurt France, I think it's individual talents, because we have players who really can make a difference and who can put all this talent on the pitch. And of course, France is going to be more pressed for all the expectations that are surrounding them. Of course, they're pointed out as one of the favorites, and it's more than fair if you've seen France play in this World Cup. They are amazing, but they haven't reached big results in the past few years. So there is the factor of the massive expectations regarding France's team, and maybe Brazil can be psychologically strong and take advantage of that, besides having really talented players like Marta, like Cristiane, like Debinha in a very inspired day. Andressinha, if she plays, she's really good in set pieces as well, in long distance shots. Formiga is always a player that can make a difference in terms of putting a structure into place during the match organizing the team. So I think especially individual talents can make a difference against this very, very, very good French team. The Brazilians in general, they're a bit suspicious about this match, but there's still hope. There's always hope. There's a saying in Brazil that like it's something like, we're Brazilians, we never give up. So that's the spirit, basically.
In Britain, there's a saying, it's the hope that kills you. So
yeah, that's the one we don't want to use.
Absolutely. It's an issue for quite a lot of these round of 16 matches, but is there anything that we can read into the fact that Brazil only found out on Thursday that they'd definitely be playing in Le Havre, and France always knew they'd be playing in Le Havre? When did the team get there, and do we think that will be a factor?
Yeah, they got here at Friday at 4:30 in the afternoon. They came by bus from Lille. Vadão was asked about that in the press conference, and he said it wasn't a problem because they've had plenty of time in between matches to prepare and to train and to rest some players. He even gave a day off to the team after the Italy match. But it is arguably a huge advantage for France. I don't know if it's huge, but it is an advantage that they are preparing. They are focusing, thinking only on the last 16 since Tuesday. And Brazil qualified Tuesday night, but they didn't really have a focus. So, and there's the traveling as well. It's always exhausting. I don't know. It's not a decisive point, but it is a point to be considered for sure.
Nathalie Jedra there. Formiga missed the last match through injury. She would have been suspended anyway. So far, Formiga's been seen jogging, so not fully participating in training. If she doesn't start, is she going to be a big miss?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, it's a difficult one. I think also at this stage, she's almost kind of more important talismanically than she is in terms of... Yeah. See, you can say my whole thoughts better at this point than I can.
That's all right.
Yeah, talismanically than she is actually from what she does on the pitch. She is this kind of icon of Brazilian football. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see whether she's risked, actually. I can see her saying that she's fit or kind of pushing herself through the fitness test because she wants to participate in this knockout match.
Yeah, and take the tallies off talismanically, and that's kind of how we're all feeling at this point of the night. But we're nearly done. As ever, we like to end with some score predictions. Brazil, France, Anne-Marie, what are you saying?
3-1 to France.
Crikey. Carrie?
4-2 to France.
Oh, goals, goals, goals. England, Cameroon, is that going to be similarly goal-laden?
2-1 England.
Close. Anne-Marie?
2-0 England.
Wow, okay. All right, well, that'll be worth watching. That's about it for this episode. Kate is back tomorrow to look back on an England win, hopefully, and ahead to Spain versus the USA and Sweden against Canada. Until then, remember you can keep up with all the latest via our social channels. It's at Offside Rule Pod on Twitter and Instagram. And head to offsiderulepodcast.com for a team of the group stage, which very controversially includes VAR as an attacking midfielder. You have to see it to believe it. Carrie, Anne-Marie, thanks for your company, and you too, listener. We'll meet again soon.
The Offside Rule Women's World Cup Edition is a Muddy Knees Media production in association with Spotify.